Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a rare meeting between North and South Korean officials yields progress.
At this point, we're seeing a little bit of a breakthrough.
Immigration reform in the U.S. continues to top the agenda for lawmakers and the president.
If you don't have the wall, you cannot have security. Just can't have it. It doesn't work.
The State Department opens an investigation into who and what may have sickened U.S. diplomats in Cuba. Also ahead, the chatter about a megastar's possible run for president. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. and United Nations welcomed steps to ease tensions between North and South Korea after the two rival states held their first face-to-face talks in 2 years. The Koreas agreed Tuesday to hold military talks to improve relations. Pyongyang also agreed to send the Winter Olympics, a delegation of high-ranking officials, athletes, a cheering squad, a taekwondo demonstration team, and a number of journalists. The rival nations said in a joint statement they've agreed to defuse the current military tension and to hold military talks to address the issue. South Korean President Moon Jae-in said that the ultimate wish is for all to have a happy life.
That is what we want. In 2018, the goal for the government and myself is we want to safeguard our common and happy life and bring more happiness to our citizens. And we will provide more to our peoples to better their life.
The White House later said President Trump has committed to sending a high-level delegation to the Olympics and praised the dialogue between Seoul and Pyongyang, made possible in part by an agreement to postpone joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises, which have angered the North. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked at Tuesday's press briefing what this all means going forward.
Certainly the next steps would be denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is our number one priority and certainly what we would like to see. We are in very close contacts with our South Korean allies about these conversations. The president spoke with Moon over the weekend. I don't believe they've spoken since then, but I know officials from our administration have been in touch with officials from the South Korean side.
Well, although North Korea dismissed the deadline to participate in the 2018 Games, the Olympic Committee could still extend invitations to compete. Japan's chief cabinet secretary also welcomed North Korean interest in joining the Games, but reiterated that Pyongyang's nuclear program remains a grave international threat and that the UN sanctions imposed on Pyongyang must continue to be strictly implemented. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden about the talks.
It's been a bit of a breakthrough in this new year in that North Korea has agreed, first of all, just to talk to South Korea. That is something that they have refused to do since President Moon Jae-in got into office in May. President Moon has been advocating for more dialogue and engagement with North Korea. And up until the eve of the Olympics here, the North Korean side has been unwilling to engage at all. So at this point, we're seeing a little bit of a breakthrough. The North Koreans will send a delegation. They will send athletes. They will send a cheering squad and journalists. And so there is kind of a sense of optimism that there will be some sort of level of cooperation, at least during the Olympics.
But apparently the talks just, from what I understand, just concentrated on the Olympics, or did they get into any other issues?
Well, they did agree to continue to have high-level talks to improve relations and to talk about security issues in the future. There have been no specific agreements to hold something that South Korea was really pushing for, which were these reunions of families that have been separated by the separation of the Korean Peninsula for the last 60 years.
Assuming once the Olympics are over, the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to hold another of their regular joint military exercises. Has there been any discussion, as far as is known at these talks, about that?
No, this has been specifically focused on the here and now, on how to cooperate to get the North Koreans into the Olympics. There's been a lot of movement in that regard, a lot of cooperation that has been up to now considered impossible almost by both sides, that something like this would happen. So North Korea is going to send a delegation. South Korea will possibly suspend international sanctions that would allow the North Korean team and North Korean officials who would be sanctioned or prohibited from any sort of international travel under the sanctions to come to the Olympics, possibly. So there's a lot of discussions just to get this moving, get this on track. And the thinking from the South Korean side is to engage the North, to build a little bit of trust, to get the dialogue restarted, and in the future, talk about these other issues. And in the meantime, there's going to be a window of opportunity in which most likely North Korea is not going to conduct a missile or nuclear test until after the Olympics are over and the Paralympics are over, so that you're talking about until almost the end of March. And the U.S. On its side has agreed that there will be no joint military drills that North Korea objects to until after the Olympics are over. So there is diplomatic space now for the two to talk about diplomacy and possibly move ahead. There is no long-term path and no solution, no long-term solution that's been agreed to in the future. But there is diplomatic space in the here and now.
That's VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Amnesty International says Myanmar must release two detained Reuters journalists. A U.S. Democratic senator releases the fusion GPS testimony in the Russia probe. Norway strengthens ties with the U.S. as the Arctic heats up. And South Korea's Zuma opens an anti-corruption probe. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump urged Congress Tuesday to reach a compromise on the fate of millions of undocumented migrants who came to the U.S. as children but didn't give ground to Democrats over his plans for a border wall.
It's wonderful. I'd love not to build the wall, but you need the wall. And I will tell you this, the ICE officers and the Border Patrol agents, I had them just recently up. They say if you don't have the wall, you know, in certain areas, obviously, that aren't protected by nature, if you don't have the wall, you cannot have security. You just can't have it. It doesn't work.
Trump hosted Republican and Democratic lawmakers at the White House for talks on the issue and allowed journalists rare access to about 1 hour of the meeting. The issue of immigration reform in the United States was a focal point of President Trump's campaign and is now at the top of the list on the agenda. Joining us to talk about the president's meeting with lawmakers and what the new year might bring for immigration reform is James Whitty, director for the Center for Immigration Research at George Mason University in the U.S. state of Virginia, just outside of Washington. Thank you for being with us, Professor. The meeting seemed to talk about a lot of things, but it didn't appear to provide a clear sense of any direction or strategy for immigration reform. What was your observation?
It seems like a lot of confusion, to be honest. You know, some of what came out of the meeting are a little bit hopeful. You know, the fact that it was a bipartisan meeting. And I think it seems that President Trump is willing to think about a comprehensive bill, including a pathway estimated 11 million unauthorized individuals in the United States.
But some of the other big issues that we've heard about, you know, the president has been promising a wall on the border with Mexico and that Mexico is going to pay for it. And it would seem that he's sort of trying to use that as leverage to pass some sort of a fix for the Dreamers, the people that did come here
right.
as children that were brought here with by their parents.
Some of the things that came out of the White House were positive, or at least hopeful, but things like the talking about the wall and making that a non-negotiable, that's not positive. I think that's divisive. You know, this is something that really has, for him, or at least he perceives it, to have value for him with his base. But again, that's probably even equally, if not more so, unrealistic than the idea of mass deportations. Now, how you would implement this, whether it would actually work, you know, that's one of the real troubling things that came out today. You know, and if you think about yesterday, the big news with regard to immigration was temporary protective status. You know, these were the current group is the 200,000 Salvadorans, but there were Nicaraguans who lost TPS, Haitians who lost TPS. That suddenly that was completely forgotten today. That was not a part of the big discussion, but it's an important immigration issue that has real ramifications for individuals' lives. You know, the estimated number of 200,000 Salvadorans, that's one thing. But then they've been here going back as far as 2001 when the earthquakes took place in El Salvador. And they've built a life here and have had roughly 190-some-odd-thousand children here who are U.S. citizens. And so the idea that you would take temporary protective status away from the parents, and what happens to the children who would then potentially be brought back to a country that they have no affiliation with, where they have no opportunity, where they're, you know, since the earthquakes have happened, one of the key issues, not only rebuilding after the earthquakes, but the gang violence that's going on there and how these kids would be negatively impacted. And by these kids, I mean U.S. citizens. So I think that's one of the really troubling aspects of this discussion on immigration that's taken place in the past, you know, actually from the beginning of the Trump administration, is the lack of attention to the complexity and the details involved and how that impacts individual lives.
How urgent do you think immigration reform is needed in this country?
I think it's very, very important, because what it can do is provide some certainty and predictability at the level of the individual, certainly, to know whether or not they're going to be able to remain in the United States to invest in a future here. But then also, if we take a step back and think about the implications for us as a country, you know, and I think what we're going to be seeing in the future, if we're not careful, is a labor shortage. And that's a shortage that we're temporarily, or at least currently, filling with a variety of new Americans, people who are here legally or with documentation, and some who are not. But it's what's kept the engine of the economy going. And to suddenly start walking in there and disrupting it is one of these complicated things that I'm not quite sure has been fully thought through. And I think that's been a hallmark of the first year of the Trump administration, is to try to make simple solutions for things that are inherently complex and rush to, you know, in the immigration area. We've seen that, for example, with the so-called Muslim ban.
Some of the things that they were talking about wanting to eliminate was chain migration and lottery visas. Do either of those things, in your view, pose a problem that need to be fixed?
I think the biggest thing to be fixed, or at least to be addressed, is these 11 million unauthorized residents, you know, foreign-born residents of the United States. And then I think we also need to think about, okay, once we've handled the status of people who are here, what kind of immigration policy do we want to have going forward? And what some people refer to as chain migration in the current law was to allow people to apply for visa status for relatives to bring family across. And that can be thought about as for humanitarian purposes and also giving advantage to the people who are already here. And so I think thinking about ways to build upon family ties, you know, I think one of the things we have to remember is family values, and that's close to the hearts of many Republicans. You know, that should be considered even across national borders. Bringing new people, new ideas, new cultures into a country helps us stay vital and young. And so I think we want to have a way for that to happen. You know, if we completely close the border, we're closing the border to people who have a lot to offer our country in the future.
That's James Witte, director for the Center, or of the Center for Immigration Research at George Mason University. Thank you for your perspective. Well, under pressure from U.S. lawmakers, the U.S. State Department said Tuesday that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will convene an accountability review board to probe the health attacks on 24 American diplomatic personnel in Cuba. Experts say it could have been a virus, could have been ultrasound, but so far, State Department officials have not been able to find out who is responsible and what methods were used. Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Western Hemisphere, Francisco Palmieri.
Throughout this process, we've not been able to identify who the perpetrator of such attack was and what the means of that attack was. It was only until late August, when there was another round of attacks, that it became apparent to us that we should begin the process of looking at an accountability review board.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Jaime Sushliki, professor emeritus of the Institute of Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at University of Miami, what do you think's happened?
My own analysis is that this happened. It happened with the knowledge of the Cuban government. Nothing like this could have happened without the Cuban government and the Cuban intelligence apparatus knowing it. It's also interesting that it began during the period where the Obama administration was trying to normalize relations to Cuba and making overtures to Cuba. So Cuba responded by doing this kind of action. It is not only the American diplomats, but there were some Canadian diplomats that were also affected.
This is resulting in what are called brain abnormalities. This is a serious issue, but what would be the possible reason behind it? Cuba denies any involvement.
Well, Cuba could have been focusing the U.S. Embassy to obtain information and maybe some electronic equipment. The Russians used to do this in Eastern Europe. So they were electronically trying to interfere with the communications, listening to the communications of the U.S. Diplomats. Maybe that's what the equipment was, and that's what produced the abnormality and the problems.
Obviously, this is going to continue to hurt improving U.S.-Cuban relations.
Well, I think that Cuban-U.S. relations is now in dead water. I don't think that the Trump administration is going to do much, even if they find that this is not caused by the Cuban government. I think the mood of the country and the mood of the administration is to try to change the regime in Cuba, to try to bring about some change in the policies of the Cuban government.
Do you agree with the assessment that, according to the Undersecretary of State, Steve Goldstein, we are not much further ahead than we were finding out why this occurred, but he insisted that President Castro's government knows what occurred and refuses to tell the U.S.?
That's probably accurate there. And look, the Cuban government is not going to tell the U.S., yes, we were doing this and we were using such and such equipment and so on. So they're not going to recognize that they've done this. They have to maintain a negative or a negating attitude. Otherwise, the punishment of the U.S. government will be even harsher than just removing a number of personnel from the intersection of the embassy.
With Mr. Castro about to leave his post, do you think the Cuban government will change significantly?
No. First of all, Raul Castro is going to remain as Secretary General of the Communist Party. That he was elected last year to a five-year term. Second, he will continue to control the armed forces. Third, policy in Cuba is made by the Politburo of the Communist Party, which is consisting of 15 members, of which 9 are military, including Raul's son, Alejandro Castro Espín, is now the coordinator of military intelligence operations. So, I mean, this is not a regime that is going to change very quickly, no.
All right, that is Jaime Sushliki, professor emeritus at the Institute of Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at University of Miami. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to what's trending on social media. And for that, we hear from VOA's Doug Bernard.
There are two big social media trends that are going on that were really inspired by the same event, the same speech, actually. But unfortunately, they've taken a rather negative turn against two women in particular. So backing up very quickly, Sunday night, last Sunday, was the Golden Globes ceremony. It's a movie and TV awards. In it, Oprah Winfrey got a Lifetime Achievement Award and made a very powerful speech in the wake of all of the allegations in Hollywood regarding powerful men and their possible sexual abuse, sexual assault, sexual harassment of women. It was a very strong speech, very empowering. Lots of women and lots of people enjoyed hearing it. And it initially sparked some conversation about, well, gosh, maybe Oprah now wants to be president. I don't know how they made that leap, but she's a great speaker. Well, today, one of the trends, of course, now is going to be hashtag Oprah 2020. But interestingly, there's really not a lot of support. I mean, there's a lot of kind of vitriol. A lot of conservatives think Oprah is just a phony Hollywood liberal. One comment I saw, just one word, Nopra. So that kind of sums up a lot of the comments. One also, a gif of her as she was giving out free cars to everybody with the words inserted in, you get welfare, and you get welfare, and you get welfare. So this is how I think a lot of people are seeing it. Not so far necessarily a groundswell of support. Now, also in that speech that Ms. Winfrey gave, she used the phrase time's up. In other words, time's up on the sexual harassers. And Ivanka Trump tweeted out a very nice comment. She said she was very inspired by Oprah's speech. She found it empowering. And she used the hashtag time's up. Well, that in turn has led a lot of, I would say, you know, sort of more progressive liberal types to really come down hard on Ivanka, you know, basically saying, look, your father has been accused by more than 16 women of sexual improprieties, let's just say. When's it time's up for him, kind of thing. So both of them really catching a lot of flack. I think it's just, you know, yet again, one of these examples of how social media can really turn and bite somebody, in unexpected ways, I guess. Not always, but this seems to be one of those cases.
All right, Doug, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And as we've been hearing from Doug, the chatter over Oprah Winfrey continues, and apparently her boyfriend of more than 30 years has been weighing in on the idea of a presidential run for Oprah. Joining us now for more is Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Hi, Nicole. So what's the scoop?
Yeah, Stedman is apparently pretty supportive of Oprah if she wants to go ahead and run for president in 2020. He did an interview with the Los Angeles Times where he basically said it's up to the people, and if the people decide, she would absolutely do it. And Oprah's talked in the past about, or she's joked in the past, that maybe she would consider running, especially after Donald Trump was elected with little to no political experience. But she kind of said, there was an interview last year where she said that she wouldn't do it, but you know, maybe with Donald Trump in the White House, maybe she did have a shot. So I guess it's up to Americans. And if we want to see Oprah 2020, Oprah would be willing to bring it to us.
Wow, that's crazy. It's always interesting when you see celebrities like them who have been together for such a long time and still seem so solid and supportive of one another. So I think that's very cool.
Yes, it's very sweet.
Well, you've also got another update on the royal wedding plans. What's going on there?
Yes, we're about 5 months away from Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's wedding, and they're getting all their ducks in a row and putting seating charts together and stuff, I'm sure. But they had this dream reception space that they really wanted to use. They wanted to use the Frogmore House, but unfortunately their party is just going to be too big, and it's going to be more practical to use St. George's Hall after their wedding at Windsor Castle on May 19th. I guess it's going to just be okay. I mean, getting married in a castle can't be that bad. But they are—they made their first royal engagement of 2018 on Tuesday. They stopped by a radio show, and there was this hilarious video of one of the DJs there just passing his card to Prince Harry, like, hey, I'm a DJ, I do weddings. So it was a very funny video. Harry had a funny reaction where he kind of, like, was caught off guard and nodded and kind of laughed. So maybe, hey, maybe that guy will get a break.
Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Journalism remains a dangerous profession in too many places around the world. On October 16th, Daphne Caruana Galizia, a journalist reporting on corruption in Malta as part of the Panama Papers investigation, was killed by a car bomb. In September, attackers set fire to the car of Yulia Latinina, a columnist for Novaya Gazeta and host of a weekly radio show in Russia. Protecting journalists and media practitioners against violence from those who may want to censor them is a core tenet of freedom of expression, said Shannon McGuire, a media advisor with USAID's Bureau for Europe and Eurasia, promoting independent media development. Since 1992, more than 800 journalists have been murdered around the world, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. Of those cases, 86% were killed with impunity, meaning no one has been held responsible. In Russia, which ranks in the top 10 of CPJ's list, the attack on Latinina was just the latest in a series of assaults and threats against Russian journalists and opposition figures that have not resulted in formal charges. In Ukraine, the murder of prominent investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet also remains unsolved more than a year later. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has prioritized support to independent media in Europe and Eurasia since beginning work there in 1992. Its programs focus both on the supply and demand sides of news and information, as well as advocating for greater press freedom. One such program is the Regional Investigative Journalism Network, which helps shield reporters from attack by making it more difficult for criminals to pinpoint those who have exposed their wrongdoings. In Ukraine, USAID's U-Media project has collaborated with more than 500 independent media outlets to ensure that professional journalists operate safely and protect their data in conflict areas in eastern Ukraine and Crimea while they report on the fighting and Russian occupation. Donors, policymakers, advocacy organizations, and civil society organizations must continue to exert pressure on those involved in censorship to ensure the continuation of open, public debate and the free flow of information. Journalists are not soldiers, and their cameras and pens are not weapons, said Ms. McGuire. They shouldn't need to fear the phrase, don't kill the messenger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.